Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, the movie geeks look back on the seminal films from the summer of 1984 with actor Peter Weller, actress Catherine Mary Stewart, and critic Keith Ulick coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to Movie Geeks United, everybody. We're very pleased to bring you this show tonight. It's become an annual tradition for us. These are always fun shows, Jerry.
They are a lot of fun. And, you know, it's really the first summer that, you know, we were on the air. You know, we didn't do this, but it was probably we should have done the 25th anniversary of the summer of 82. And
right.
That would have been the greatest thing. But we started with the summer after that, and, you know, hopefully, I hope that we'll do these every year, because as we go on through the 80s, they're just great summers. There's a lot to talk about for the rest of the decade.
It's really like revisiting a more innocent time for our age group.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm speaking for myself. I don't know how innocent you were back then, but
it's an interesting summer. I'll say this. Let me say this right now. I went to this is the only time I went overseas that summer.
Oh, really?
In the middle, I went to England and France. That summer, and I was it was a summer in between junior high and high school, and I went to meet a friend of mine I had met in Palm Beach, actually, at the Breakers, and stayed with him and his family. And that's like really the dividing point, actually, if you think of the movies and everything.
Yeah.
Because when you get back, it's like Karate Kid, Revenge of the Nerds. My brother and my mom saw Purple Rain while I was away, so it's really interesting. The dividing point in between the big blockbusters that first half of the summer. And then when you get into August,
we're going to be talking about all those. First of all, let me get a sense of. I was 11 this year.
Okay.
Not this year, but 1984.
No, I realize that.
And you're a couple of years older.
I was 13, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Because that's valuable, I think.
When
we're talking about our reflections from these movies at that time. Just to let everyone know, before we bring on our first guest and talk about our first film, which is a really exciting guest and film, I want to tell everyone what this is. We are covering tonight primarily the latter part of the summer of 1984, meaning the July and August releases. And we're doing so with Catherine Mary Stewart, who we're bringing on in a moment for The Last Starfighter, and Peter Weller, who's coming up a little bit later to talk about Buckaroo Banzai. And our one of our favorite critic friends, Keith Ulick,
mm-hmm.
will review Purple Rain and all that great stuff. Another Blog Talk Radio show that our listeners know very well is Back by Midnight. And he is, Aaron Anadia is the host of that,
mm-hmm.
is covering the first half of the summer. He did that last night. And then he's going to do a recap show tomorrow evening.
Right.
And he's got great people like Joe Dante and William Atherton and
mm-hmm.
Joseph Rubin. Taking part in his show,
yes,
so this is an exciting three-night event.
Yeah, I promoted earlier Aaron's show and The House Next Door. The House Next Door Keith
yes.
site is just written some. There's a great essay this week about the Karate Kid that you guys have
very moving.
Read.
Yeah,
it's very emotional and it's just an incredible essay. But Keith's been posting great work on there all week. All these wonderful writers. I really suggest people go check it out. The House Next Door, one of the finest sites
yes.
out there.
TheHouseNextDoorOnline.com is where you'll find those writings. Okay, let's get to our first film. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, here we go.
Come on, Alex!
Alex Rogan had a dream.
You really are leaving here, aren't you?
To be as far away from here as possible.
You get your chance when it comes.
You gotta grab it with both hands.
It started with a game.
You're gonna bust the record.
But it wasn't just any game.
You have been recruited by the Star League to defend the frontier against Sewer and the Kodan Armada.
And then, one night...
Centauri's the name. We have to talk about a matter of utmost importance. Step into my office. I've seen him come and I've seen him go, but you're the best, my boy. Light years ahead of the competition.
Hey. Alex didn't find his dream.
Recruited by the Star League
to defend the frontier against Xur and the Kodan Armada.
Of all the life forms on all the planets in all the galaxies.
Oh my God!
One has been chosen. Rogan.
Alex?
Is the last starfighter. For every Earthling who's ever imagined traveling beyond the stars.
Maybe there is a starfighter left.
I love you, Alex Rogan.
Comes the unforgettable story of one who made it. The last starfighter.
That takes you right back to your youth, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
It really does.
Yes, it does.
Back when the video game craze first caught on like a fever, what kid didn't dream of achieving that high score and being recruited to use those skills to save the galaxy from invasion? I mean, come on.
It was a big deal back then. It still is, but definitely.
Yeah, The Last Starfighter hit the zeitgeist all right, and it remains a timeless and beloved film to this day. Released on July 13th, 1984, the film starred Lance Guest, Robert Preston, and our first guest this evening. Catherine Mary Stewart is a terrific actress with extensive credits in film and television, including Night of the Comet, The Sea Wolf, World Gone Wild, and Weekend at Bernie's. Her latest film is the critically acclaimed and audience favorite, I've heard so many raves about this film, Love and Dancing. And we're privileged to welcome her to Movie Geeks United tonight, Miss Catherine Mary Stewart. Miss Stewart, are you with us?
I am.
Welcome.
But how did you know it was me? I mean, I just dialed this number you gave me, and it's like, what? How do they know I'm here?
It's Russian roulette with these phone calls.
Honest to God, it's like there was this long... you know, I don't know. It said, if you want to get on the list, just press 1. And I'm like, okay, I guess I'll get on the list. I don't know.
You're on a very long list here tonight, but we appreciate you being here so much. And this movie obviously means a lot to so many people, including us. We have such fond memories of it, and it takes us back every time we watch it again. But tell me a little bit about your ambitions and your career leading up to this, because I understand that you were primarily interested in dancing.
Yeah, I was. I was a dancer before all this. First of all, I love you, movie geeks. You make my life worthwhile.
Hey, we love you, okay? You made high school a lot more bearable, okay?
Oh, good. I'm so happy. I was a dancer. I grew up in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and I was a dancer there and a professional dancer. After high school, I went to London and studied dance, and that's where I got into acting. I auditioned as a dancer for a movie called The Apple, which was this bizarro rock musical, which actually has its own little cult following.
It does.
25, 30 years later, I'm like, huh? What? You know. But it's so anyway, that got me into acting, and you know, lead role in a movie was on my resume all of a sudden. So when I moved to Los Angeles, it was like, I guess also they're always in Los Angeles. It's such a machine that they're always looking for a new fresh face, and
mm-hmm.
I had a little experience behind me, so it kind of got me out there, you know. And honestly, it all just sort of snowballed. I didn't have any preconceived ideas of what it was I was going to do. I was a dancer, and then I was all of a sudden this actress. I thought, well, I'll just go with that for a while and see what happens. You know,
right.
You're young, you're naive, you just kind of go with the flow. And I was having a lot of fun. And when I first arrived in Los Angeles, it was a bit of a, you know, struggle in terms of I had to all of a sudden do this whole auditioning thing and you know, wondering how I would pay my rent and things like that.
Right.
And I ended up in a soap opera, Days of
mm-hmm.
Our Lives.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was doing the soap opera, I auditioned for The Last Starfighter and got that. So during The Last Starfighter, I was doing Days of Our Lives at the same time. And it was just a whirlwind. And you know, there's something about being young and naive that is just kind of, you know, you just go along with it,
mm-hmm.
and I'm having a good time, and I'm sitting in L.A. with the beaches and the palm trees.
Right, right.
And I'm going, this is a good thing, and I don't even care what happens next.
That's a great life. Yeah,
yeah,
that's a great time.
Yeah.
So that must have been a grind. You're doing Days of Our Lives, I imagine, during most days.
Well, they actually gave me some time off to do the movie.
Okay.
So it worked out. There were some days that I had to do both. A lot of The Last Starfighter was shot at night. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, you shoot the show during the day and then drive out to the desert in the night. Honestly, I didn't care. I was just having a good time. I was enjoying every second of it.
What were your impressions of the material for The Last Starfighter?
You know, I've been asked this before, but again, I was just like, okay, I'll do that. You know? I mean, I thought the story was very sweet, but truly I was sort of, I remember specifically auditioning for it and feeling really great about it and having a callback. And Lance and I read together in the callback, and we just kind of clicked.
Mm-hmm,
I remember sitting in the callback in front of whoever it was, the director and the producers and all that other stuff, and he and I were kind of ad-libbing a little bit, but we felt extremely comfortable together. It just felt very, very natural.
Yeah.
And it felt like that through the entire process of making the movie. Even before we started shooting, he and I would get together and talk about our characters and our relationship and all that other stuff, which seems like that's what actors are supposed to do, but often you don't have time to do that, or you don't really like the person you're working with anyway, or something like that. But he and I, it was a very comfortable fit.
Yeah.
And he was terrifically giving as an actor. And honestly, I really was coming into this whole thing very naively and truly just having a great time and really no preconceived ideas of what it would all mean or anything like that. I'd done this other movie. I'd done a couple of other movies. I did a small thing in Canada as well. And I don't know, you know, I wasn't somebody who sat there and planned out my whole life.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Which, in retrospect, it was so great, because maybe that made everything a little fresher in a way. I don't
know. And you were living in the moment. And
right.
I think, and that's a valuable lesson for any actor as well. I mean,
right. I think that's important, but, you know, everybody is different. Everybody works differently. Some people really need to have everything planned out precisely. I mean, I think a lot of things have changed for me over the years. So,
but in that business, especially, you can't plan everything out. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work around your schedule, the individual schedule. There are much greater forces at work, bigger things at work. So you probably had the best attitude.
Well, but I also remember years and years ago meeting Tom Cruise in an audition. And man, he knew what he wanted. He was the most determined little guy I'd ever met. I was like, I mean, it was before he was Tom Cruise, you know.
Right.
I think it was we were auditioning for The Outsiders. And I was like, well, he's kind of cute. Maybe he'll ask me out or something. And we left the audition together. He's like, you know, I don't normally let myself be put on tape, but in this case, you know, he's blah, 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 blah. And I was like, do you want to, get an ice cream? This is me. And he's like, and this is how my entire life is going to go. And I'm like, okay,
wow.
Nice meeting you. And hey, you know, I look at that now and I'm like, well, of course he's where he is now. Cause
that's one determined guy right there.
He was
so determined.
Mm-hmm. It sort of blew you away how determined he was.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it paid off for him a little bit. You know, not much, but.
but by the sound of it, I mean, it sounds like such a wonderful time for you, but the actual set of The Last Starfighter, was it a familial kind of environment on the set?
It was so terrific on the set. I mean, Nick Castle, first of all, the director, is like a big kid.
Mm-hmm.
And he obviously loved every second of what we were doing. And it really is, on any set, it's a trickle-down thing. If the director's a jerk, then you're not going to have a good time. Nobody's going to be happy, and it's just going to wear off on everybody. But Nick Castle just has this joie de vivre, you know, it was a joy. It was a joy working on that set. Everybody was terrific. Lance and I had this great time, and all the kids, you know, in the trailer park were great, and the adults too. I ran into Ellen Blake, who played Clara. I don't, she's one of the ladies in the park, you know.
Right,
I forget exactly what her line was, her stuff was, that she was one of the characters. And I ran into her in New York, and it was like, you know, almost like running into your grandma again, you know. And I have such fond memories of everybody in the trailer park. It truly was like just a happy set. Everybody was having a good time. And it wasn't the most comfortable, you know, working conditions out there in the middle of nowhere. And like I said, mostly night shooting, which means, you know, you drive out there at 6 p.m., you start working at 9, you're like trying to get the last shot before the sun rises at 4:30 in the morning. And there's something, I swear to God, there's something about the temperature. It drops like 20 degrees at 5. And everybody's like, you know. But yeah, it was really it couldn't have been a better situation. I mean, I was really lucky to have one of my first movies be that idyllic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. And Nick Castle, he is terrific, and he actually did another film that I know people really took to their hearts even years later with The Boy Who Could Fly. Another wonderful movie. Did you have interaction with Robert Preston? I know this was his last film, I believe.
It was his last film.
Yeah.
And I just happened to cross paths with him after the main shoot was over. We were doing some pickup stuff at in a studio at Lorimar, and he happened to have a couple of scenes or something like that. I'm not sure what he was shooting, but he was shooting before I arrived and had wrapped when I got there, and I got to meet him because we never had any scenes together. And I was so happy to meet him because he was one person I, you know, knew was a huge star, and I was disappointed that I couldn't, I wasn't working with him. So as he was leaving, I think Nick probably introduced me to him because I was so shy and I was just like, oh my God. And he was one of those actors that just has this glow, or maybe it was just the way I felt about him, but he literally glowed, and he was exactly what you would expect him to be. His personality is just what it is on screen. It's larger than life and incredibly warm, and he took my hand and he kissed it, and he didn't know who I was, you know. He knew, I guess, basically who the character was, but I was just like, I'm never washing my hand. One of those totally cliche things, but that was my meeting with Robert Preston.
Wow.
It was unforgettable. And the other thing I have to say, though, you know, Dan O'Herlihy has quite a had quite a resume himself.
Yes, he does.
And but honestly, I never saw him out of his Grieg makeup. And so we did this a few months ago in Los Angeles. We did this 25th anniversary, you know, interview thing for the release of the 25th anniversary CD or DVD for Last Starfighter. And I thought, you know, I really ought to figure out who this Dan O'Herlihy guy is. So I watched him. In one of his movies, not Swiss Family Robinson, but
I keep thinking you want to say Failsafe, the original Failsafe.
No, it was like Robinson Crusoe. Excuse me. Oh my gosh, I watched him in Robinson Crusoe, 1954 movie, so that I could, you know, actually, sort of in my mind at least, identify him. So that was, I mean, another terrific, amazing actor.
Wow. Did you have any, of course, I don't think you could have any inkling as to the longevity this film would enjoy, but when did you realize that? When did you realize that this had hit a nerve?
I would say about 3 years ago. I live in New York now, and although I've kept my finger in the acting pot all these years, I've really been sort of out of the loop. But I decided about 3 years ago to really go back to L.A. and see if I can't get a little bit of work here and there or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I started auditioning again, and these casting guys who are in, like, their 30s, you know, I would come in to read for something, and they would just be looking at me with these wide eyes and their mouths open, and they'd be like, oh, my God, I remember you when I was 12, and you were like my first crush. And I was like, you know, blown away by this. It was like, are you serious? What? I had no idea. I had no idea that this whole sort of generation of boys had watched this, and it had, and girls as well, by the way, had had that sort of influence. And, you know, you sort of sit down and you kind of analyze it and everything, and there are not a lot of movies like that nowadays where this simple boy from a trailer park is thrust into this situation, you know, that makes him this kind of a superhero sort of guy. It gives the audience a sense of possibility, and I don't think you get that so much anymore. I mean,
I don't think so either. I think that innocence is missing. Yeah, I think that
the
movie's very hopeful and innocent, and what I see a lot of now is cynicism. You know,
Jamie Olin. It's that cynicism in there. Yeah,
the cynicism or just pure escapism, where it's just like you're just blasted with.
It's hard to really focus
on it. And I got a lot of that, I get that sort of reaction from girls with the movie Night of the Comet that I did with Kelly Maroney.
That's another great one.
Right.
I
mean,
it puts these
girls in this extraordinary situation that they have to sort of figure out. They're just these regular Valley girls, you know. Mm-hmm. And I hear from women, you know, how that really empowered them somehow. And again, you don't, I mean, it may even be more so for you know, women characters in films that
sure.
have that sort of influence. And it's too bad. It's sorely missed, I think.
I think so, too. But just to echo part of what you just said, we have tons of people in our chat room currently really had a major crush on you as well during their formative years.
The two of us in the whole entire chat room. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. I wish you guys had been, you know, around when I was in my 20s. I'm just walking around with my finger up my nose.
Another movie that you were in, Mischief, was a big, very popular with all of us in high school, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh.
That was a lot. We enjoyed that one a lot, too. Still do.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I just watched that recently myself. And Doug McKeon, who was in that, we just hooked up again. This is the other thing, is that it's been all these years, and this whole life has gone by. I now have a 16-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old son, and all these years have gone by, and I hooked up with Doug McKeon this spring for the first time since Mischief, and he's just the greatest guy ever with the cutest kids. Oh my God, it was so much fun, and he's directed some stuff, and he writes and he produces, and also Kelly Maroney from Night of the Comet. I had lunch with her when I was in Los Angeles this spring, and I hadn't seen her, I don't know how long, you know, since just a few years after. So it's like reliving this whole thing again, which is kind of cool. I mean, I never expected it, and I never sort of sat around pining for it. But gosh, it's so much fun to relive all this stuff and just laugh and have a good time about it.
Yeah, and we feel the same way when we're able to relive these movies and speak to talents like yourself that were such a major part of our youth, because they're movies are immortal and they're just so powerful for us. But when you look at The Last Starfighter, or you rewatch Night of the Comet, or any of the other early films you were involved in, what does that feel like for you? In a way, is it almost like watching very expensive home movies in a strange way?
I guess in a way, but not really. I mean, the neatest thing for me actually is, I think it was either last year or the year before. You know, this is going to sound very self-centered, but both my kids for their birthday parties had sleepovers. And they played like Night of the Comet and The Last Starfighter to their friends, which to me was like, you know, it was just cool that they'd even want to do that.
Yeah.
That's the most important. It was just like, oh, man, I can't believe that they actually care about this. So that was really, really cool. But, I mean, watching you feel a little removed, I have to say. I mean, it's kind of, I sort of look at myself and don't recognize myself, really. I mean, I look so young, and I've changed so much in so many ways, physically as well as in my acting and all that other stuff. But I'm really proud of those movies, because I think, you know, it was lucky that I did them. It wasn't like a conscious choice on my part that I'm going to do some movie that will have longevity and will make some sort of a statement. I know that I've never had any desire to do, I don't know how to describe it, maybe morally suspect movies or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's never entered sort of my, if anything like that came up, it would just be like, no thanks. But so I guess that served me well in many ways. But I guess basically in my naivete at that time, there's some pride there too.
Yeah, I would think so. But you have, so many years have gone by, and I'm sure you are a different actress now than you were then. How has that enjoyment of the craft of acting deepened for you over the years, do you think?
Well, you know, as an actor, life experience is so important. So I think that hopefully it comes across anyway, my acting has deepened or has more dimension, hopefully. I can draw on so much more life experience. And it's funny because I always played a lot younger than I was, and I still do, actually. I look younger than I am, apparently.
Well, you're very beautiful.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I'm not saying that to, you know, try to get a compliment or something. It's just, I think 24 when I did Last Starfighter. I was supposed to be like 17, but that's just genetics, plain and simple. But I've always had this, because I've always been looked at as younger than I am, even if, by strangers and everything, I've always wanted to be older. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So as I get older, I'm actually loving it. I love being older. My mother used to say to me, you know, people that have no lines in their face never smile.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, that's always sort of stuck with me, that as my face matures and I have lines, Lord knows I've had a lot of laughs in my day. I'm a smiling person. Anybody who knows me will tell you that. I'm just like, well, except my husband. I'm a bitch to him. But, those are the frown lines I have. But, you know, I enjoy sort of the aging process. So it's on many levels, not only for my work, but just growing into myself. And, you know, you just can't help but have more confidence, or you just know yourself better. And and it's a good thing. It's a really good thing.
And you have come back into films, and as I mentioned, your latest is Love and Dancing.
Right.
Is there anything else upcoming? Any other projects on the horizon?
I just did a Lifetime movie called A Neighbor's Secret, which I'm not exactly sure when it'll be out, but it'll probably in the fall. So that'll be on Lifetime TV. And let me think, Love and Dancing. And I've done, you know, like a thing for Spike TV and a couple of other Lifetime movies, that kind of stuff. I'm just kind of poking away.
Yeah, but you're doing great, and
yeah.
I've seen many of the recent movies that you've done, and you're still just terrific. And I want to thank you from all of us for being such a big part of our childhood, and this has been just a big joy for us to have you on tonight.
Yes,
well,
it is.
It's a pleasure, and it's such a wonderful surprise for me to, you know, be around still and have the recognition that you guys, that the audience that makes up you guys, it gives me. It's just crazy to me, but it's wonderful, and I do not take it for granted for a second. And thank you.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank
and
you.
Come back anytime.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Thanks a lot.
Okay, that is Catherine Mary Stewart, The Last Starfighter.
The Last Starfighter. We've been having like this huge conversation about like old video games in the chat room.
You know, but what a smart movie.
You
because
know, it was way ahead of its time.
Yeah, like I said in the intro, it was the beginnings of this Atari or arcade game craze, and for every kid that was just immersed in that world, what a great idea for a film to come out of at that time. And it just, you know, it inspired the dreamer in you, and it was just a great positive movie.
Mm-hmm.
And movies like that, like E.T., like Last Starfighter, they really do bring you right back to that feeling of childhood.
Yes, they do.
If you watch them during those formative years.
Mm-hmm.
Movies are magical.
Yes, they are.
Let's get to our next movie. Speaking of a magical movie.
Yeah.
This is one of the most offbeat movies ever made.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. What can you say about – I mean, talking to Peter Weller, he wasn't sure what to say about describing the movie.
But while we were talking to him, I thought of a lot of – I just thought of a lot of things I'll share after the interview that, like, the impact the movie has had in the most unexpected places. And I'd be more than happy to share it. But I was like, while he was talking about and describing, like, his reaction to the script and – how he was going to play it. It's just amazing where you see the, I think where you see the influence today.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it very influential movie. And we will cover that once the interview is concluded. Let's mention some of our next guest's credits. What a great career he's had, and a terrific actor that he is. The New Age, Naked Lunch,
RoboCop.
I mean, that's the biggie. You can't get much bigger than
that.
And
he was on 24 recently.
24. A fantastic actor, Mighty Aphrodite. He's worked with some of the great filmmakers. He's a great, strong, charismatic presence on screen, one of our great actors. And we were thrilled to welcome him onto the show. The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai is the big cult film on his resume, as it is on many actors' resumes, such as John Lithgow and Jeff Goldblum.
Would you say even more cultish than Naked Lunch?
You know, it's a very...
Because that's another big cult film, too, but I was just curious.
The Buckaroo Banzai, I think the tone of Buckaroo Banzai, the playful tone, kind of lends itself more to a larger cult status.
I think I'll go with that.
I could be mistaken.
No, because, I mean, it's a movie, as our audience will find out. I don't even think people would know what to do with it today, and executives. I don't think anyone will ever know what to do with it.
Well, we'll talk more about it on the other end of this.
Yeah.
This is an actor we both admire greatly, Mr. Peter Weller, revisiting his Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai experience.
Evil! Pure and simple from the eighth dimension!
I'm not ready for this.
So what? Big deal.
Salutations, great Buckaroo Banzai. A common great danger confronts both our worlds.
These are Martian names. John Webb, John Fat Eating, John Icicle Boy.
Martian.
In New Jersey.
Buckaroo, President on Line 1 calling about, is everything okay with the alien space club and Planet 10, or should he just go ahead and destroy Russia?
Tell him yes on 1 and no on 2.
Which was yes, destroy Russia or the number 2?
Worth it, Buckaroo. Forget about me.
They'll
never break me.
Penny, get off the phone.
We're giving you a chance to save your planet.
I want
to
let's talk a little bit about Buckaroo Banzai. It's a tremendous cult classic now, but when you were first offered the script, as I understand it, you were a little hesitant about doing it.
Well, I was only hesitant about doing it because there was another movie in the works, and I thought maybe I wanted to be the romantic lead, at least in a movie that I understood.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. But the thing is that
the romantic lead looked to be going to somebody else between me and another guy in the other film. And the more I read Buckaroo, the more, you know, I realized it was going to be remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Unique, yeah.
And what could you take in your discussions with the director? What was your understanding of what the tone of the film would be?
I didn't know what the tone of the film would be. You know, I know what the genre was. I mean, the head of marketing at 20th Century, after the film was wrapped, asked me, what is this film? So I didn't know what the genre. I knew it was funny. I knew there were funny guys in it. I knew it was an action movie. You know, I knew it was also sort of a spiritual film.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I knew it was metaphysical. It was sci-fi. I didn't know what the hell it was.
Right.
And truly upon wrapping it, this wonderful woman, whose name I forget, God bless her, you know, said, "What do you think this film is?" I said, "I don't know." Finally, an editor friend of mine, a guy named Dean Goodhill, later got an Oscar nomination for Fugitive, said, "I'll tell you what that film is. It's a comedy, pure and simple."
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is.
Yeah, it didn't take itself seriously. It had fun with itself, very tongue-in-cheek. That's what we loved about it. We got all the jokes and everything. It was like someone took, there was a movie a couple years before that came out called Megaforce, which took itself so seriously, and this was almost like a parody of that. But, I mean...
Yeah, but you know what? I don't think it was a parody, though. I have to really say, that's the one thing I want to stay away from. It's not a satire.
Hmm.
And it's not a parody. I mean, if you've ever met Earl Mac Roush, you would know that he wasn't writing a parody of sci-fi or action. He was truly writing a sort of a metaphysical comedy. There's no film like Buckaroo. I have to tell you this because, not only because I'm in it, or John Lithgow's in it, or Christopher Lloyd, or you know, all of the other, or Goldblum, all of whom are still remain very dear friends, Ellen Barkin. But you know, we all know that it's not a satire. It's not a goof.
No,
it's
not
a parody.
Goof. Right.
It's not.
Right.
No, it's not a parody. It's not. So it's not really built on any. You know, it's got several genres in it, but it's not really based on anything. And it's dense enough whereby, to this day, when I run into John Lithgow, we go, "What was that movie about?"
What fascinates me about how you built this character, you read about certain actors that prepare characters based on other individuals. Kind of, they make an amalgam of these different personalities. And you, where did you go for inspiration for Buckaroo Banzai?
I went to Jacques Cousteau and Adam Ant. those are the two people on whom I based this. First, I'd seen interviews with Jacques Cousteau, and I thought, my God, how does that guy get so many things done?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I just always not overwhelmed at his fantastic. Look, the guy's a fantastic mariner. He's a marine biologist. He invented the scuba.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jacques Cousteau invented scuba.
Yes.
Did you know that?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that, and. And not only that, he was a scientist and a photographer. He had to be all those things to be on his boat, and that's what he was. And, you know, he'd be on TV, and he'd be talking about all these things he'd accomplished in a year. And thought, you know, that sort of razzmatazz bag of talent that Jacques Cousteau was. And then I was a big Adam Ant fan. And Adam Ant sort of, I don't know, he was sort of... you know, he was an iconoclast. He was sort of anti-image, but he had his own image, and he was, you know, a throwback, sort of retro, but sort of modern. And I still like Adam Ant to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So there was something about Adam Ant. There was something about Adam Ant that was unique in his whole wonderful presentation and singing. And you know, I got to play the trumpet, a little bit of guitar, and sing. And
you are a musician. And if I understand correctly, you still play with Mr. Goldblum as well occasionally, right?
You know, I do play. I still play in a sextet, and when Mr. Goldblum's in town, he's not in town, like, you know, we do play together. Right now I'm playing in a sextet without him, but I'll play with him again when he comes back for sure,
right.
Because I love playing with Jeff, and we started off playing together. And Woody Allen, both Woody Allen and Miles Davis are the two people who personally inspired us to put a band together.
Wow.
Oh, goodness.
That's incredible.
And you,
and
you worked with Woody Allen.
I did work with Woody Allen. And
yeah,
Woody Allen's, probably Woody Allen's, one of his dearest friends is his set photographer, a guy named Brian Hamill, who's also extraordinarily famous for posters. He did the great poster of the last quarter century of Robert De Niro and Raging Bull.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But he's won all sorts of awards for his posters. And The Natural with Redford and on and on and on and stuff. But he's done all the great Woody posters and set photography of Manhattan. And Woody and I had met through Brian because he's one of my dearest friends. And Brian's also the brother of Pete Hamill and John Hamill and Dennis Hamill, great writing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I met Woody a while before I worked with him. So although honored to work with Woody, you know, it was not like a new deal. Like, I felt like I'd known Woody a long time. Also, we have jazz in common, and Woody's... fairly prolific in his knowledge about jazz.
When you're actually shooting the film, what was the biggest challenge for you?
The biggest challenge for me was not to bust out laughing.
Yeah.
In every scene I had, because I was surrounded by extraordinarily funny people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Ellen Barkin is hysterical, and Pepe Serna, and Goldblum, and Clancy Brown, and there's a scene where Lloyd and Lithgow are tying me to that torture chamber.
Yeah.
I laughed. I think I blew 50 takes. I was laughing so hard.
Yeah, I was just thinking, how did you keep a straight face with all those people around?
I couldn't keep a straight face. I mean, those guys are hysterical. Lloyd, my oldest friend, Lloyd and I and Lithgow know each other back from the theater days in New York, back in the early 70s. And I did a couple of plays with Lloyd. I never got the honor to act with Lithgow on stage, but that's how far we go back. So, you know, Lloyd shows up, big boute, big boute. And, you know, and there's Lithgow with this outrageous Italian, Emiliano Lizardo. And, you know, they're going to, you know, and they're doing this banter. Can you know, the whole scene is between them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Monkey Boy. I was laughing my way through the whole film. The music was a challenge. I'd never sung in a film. It was a pleasure to do that. That was a big challenge. But the whole film was a hoot. I have to say that there was nothing, you know, like Naked Lunch was very difficult. There were many, the parts of RoboCop that were just extraordinarily grueling and
mm-hmm.
athletic. But Buckaroo mm-hmm. was like a dream come true.
Yeah.
It was just wonderful.
Well, I know that there are big expectations around the film, and it didn't perform as well as was hoped, but years later it gained a cult following, as we've mentioned. What didn't people get about it upon its release that they got years later?
Look, I had to put everything on the shoulders of marketing, but, you know, they always say that a film doesn't open because it's not marketed right. Any film can open, but, you know, that's whether it hangs on, it's got legs. But they didn't know what that film was.
Right.
You know, maybe today we still don't know. Maybe in retrospect we know it's a comedy, like my friend Dean Goodhill said. But they didn't know how to market it. You know,
mm-hmm.
they didn't
right.
know what the thing was. They, you know, there's funny scenes. If you get the DVD, you know, with all the cut scenes. When all those guys are driving, they offer them some battery. And, you know, Lloyd says, no, thank you, I'm driving. You know, there's stuff in it, you know, that they cut out of it that I think they should have left in it and geared the whole deal to a comedy. But I just have to say that I don't think it performed well because, and it was no fault of anyone, because I don't think that they knew what they had.
Right.
And they didn't know how to, you know, drive it with one marketing deal. You know, you got a horror film, for instance, you got a comedy, you know, you got an action film, yeah, throw that into the trailers and, I don't know. That's my take. That's my two cents on it.
When it was released on home video that following year, we had rented it because my mom and I saw it when it came out in the theaters, and we loved it, and we brought it home for everyone to watch. And I noticed the film, like, in high school and with everything around the area, gained the, you know, people started to watch it and really enjoyed it. They really got into it. And that was in 85.
Yeah. And, well, people, you know, have come up to me all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And know things about the film, and not just the, you know, the techies that are, like, all into the film because they're, like, into films and into, like,
right.
You know, offbeat or zen-like comedies, but just people who dig the film for what it is, you know, that it's, like, it's an original statement of the possibilities of the compassion of mankind, you know,
right.
to save himself. That's what it really is, and I think that's what the message is there, and people love the message, and look, you know, at the end of it, you know, a Rastafarian, a black Rastafarian alien says, "So what? Big deal." Show me another film that's got that in it.
You got me there.
Even so, there's been for years and years talk of a sequel. What have you ever heard anything come of that?
Oh, they talk about a sequel all the time. They talk about a television series. They talk about this and that. And sadly, The major producer, David Beagle, and bless his heart, killed himself. And
mm-hmm.
then the guy who owned the studio, Bruce McNall, you know, went away for a while to, you know, the federal farm. And but now he's back and doing well, and I stay in touch with him. And, you know, I don't know what the confusion is about ever getting a sequel together, but what the tie-up of it was, but 20th Century didn't seem to be behind the thing, and they're still talking about a series.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. It still got major currency and a very loyal fan base, the whole Buckaroo Banzai universe.
Buckaroo Banzai universe. Yes, perfect, Tommy. Yes.
Mr. Weller, we love your work, and actually Jerry and I were just talking the other day, and we were going on and on about Naked Lunch and the New Age.
Yeah, you did such great work with Judy Davis. Will you work with her again? Because you have great chemistry on screen together.
You know what Judy Davis said to me, that as we were wrapping the New Age, a film I really am honored to have been part of.
I love that film.
Michael Culkin.
That's a great film.
You know what, to this day, in spite of the fact that I'm in it, it's still the most frightening film about Los Angeles. I don't know if you guys live in Los Angeles, but...
For a little bit, I did.
Well, you know, it's a frightening place. You know?
Yeah, oh, it is.
It's like air, you know?
Yeah.
There's nothing really of concrete to sort of grab onto.
Yeah, but I...
And that film is, you know, what the, as I say in Latin, the nec plus ultra of films about Los Angeles, about what's frightening about Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
But Judy Davis said on the day we wrapped that film, after doing Naked Lunch and then The New Age, she turned to me and she said, you know... We've become the Astaire and Rogers of the dysfunctional relationship.
That's a great relationship. That's great.
She's brilliant, though. I just have to think about her, though. She's possibly, like, I've worked with Diane Wiest and Diane Keaton and her. And I worked with a host of people, but I'd say the three standout people I've worked with, like Kazan said, you know, a good actress is infinitely more interesting than even a great actor. You know, because they have a certain sense of abandon that actors don't have. He said that, unless you're Marlon Brando, who's the most abandoned of all.
Right.
But I have to say, so the greatest people I've worked with are women. And of those three women, you know, I have to say that Judy Davis is maybe something. You just, when you were acting with Judy Davis, yeah, you know, it's like what Fred Astaire said about Sid Charisse. When you dance with Sid Charisse, you stay danced. Well, you know, you act with Judy, you just throw your car in neutral and let her invent, because there's nothing that I could ever come up with that could compete with the music, you know, in her. So
she is
right.
Phenomenal. And we were talking about Woody Allen earlier, and just incredible performances she's given in Woody Allen's films.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Oh, incredible.
I don't think there's a Judy Davis performance I've ever seen that doesn't just blow me away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, she just has got stuff in her that, you know, that's, you know, endless.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mr. Weller, please come back and talk to us sometime in the future, because we're crazy about you here.
Yeah.
Well, love you guys. I'm very honored that you called me. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise.
You too, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And listen, thank you for celebrating Buckaroo, too. I really appreciate you guys doing that.
Okay, Peter Weller, conversation about The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah, fantastic interview.
Yeah, he was very good, and we didn't even touch upon RoboCop. I mean, I'm sure everywhere he goes he's asked about RoboCop.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, he may be the better for it. I mean, I don't know. I love RoboCop. I think it actually holds up very well, more, you know, but We just didn't have the time, you know?
No, but I just say that to illustrate that he's been in these films that have really stood the test of time and once again hit the zeitgeist, you know. RoboCop is one for the ages.
I think so.
And people will be scratching their heads for many more years about Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So tell me your thoughts on Buckaroo Banzai.
So he's talking about this. He's talking about Jacques Cousteau, and the thing, we had talked about this a couple of days before the interview. You know, we talked about the closing credits for The Life Aquatic, which are definitely influenced by Buckaroo, but then you go back and you actually think about the whole movie. It's very influenced by Buckaroo Banzai. The character, I'm not saying Steve Zissou definitely has a lot of Buckaroo Banzai's offbeat characteristics, you know, his the inventions, the science, the geekness of the character, the combination of humor and science and all that, and it's there in the movie. I mean, it's there at various points, and also you have Jeff Goldblum in the movie.
Right.
And I think that's a telling thing right there. I'm sure people have touched on this before. I'm not really saying anything new, but it just struck me how much, at various points of the life aquatic, wow, you know, this really owes something to Buckaroo in many ways.
And you can also tell how it's entered the bloodstream of the mm-hmm. culture by dialogue that gets quoted. And
yeah.
I think you know, the big thing from Buckaroo Banzai, wherever you go, there you are, has
yeah.
been quoted so often that
mm-hmm.
People forget the source.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's another movie. I don't know. Is Keith on the line yet, or?
Not yet. Keep going.
Okay, I wanted to talk. You know, people, you had mentioned the Red Dawn remake.
Yeah.
And, you know, that film was already dated almost even before the Berlin Wall came down, actually. But that movie's kind of already been remade. And I couldn't help but notice while watching
Chuck Norris Invasion USA.
No. Actually, just because of the structure of the film, I'm thinking of is Defiance. Defiance, in its own weird way, owes
right.
a lot to Red Dawn because of the relationship, because of the brothers, and you form this resistance. But that reminded me a lot of Red Dawn. I couldn't get it out of my mind while watching that earlier this year.
Right. I remember Red Dawn. We'll be talking about Red Dawn a little bit later with Keith,
yeah.
but. I remember how it's really Milius's voice, you know, for
that
obvious reasons. It's a Milius film, but
it's Milius 100% in that film.
Bombastic, balls out, ridiculous. I mean, it's it's got all those qualities that I find.
That it's got all the John Milius qualities we love. It's just amazing. Yeah, it's funny, in the 90s that film took on a whole new life because it turned out that film has this whole other life as a militia recruiting film and training film. Like, militias watched that film
right.
as, like, to get pointers and everything. That broke during the 90s. This is stuff you find out when you first go online, when you first get internet access to some of the things you find out. I'm telling you. But it's amazing what the shelf life that movie has. Now, I have to ask you, what is the remake going to be about? It obviously can't be a Soviet invasion with Nicaraguans and Cubans coming in the country.
I don't know. I probably same plot, different invaders. I mean,
okay.
That would be my guess. I think it's really a you know, new star or new unknown kind of.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, you know, MTV generation film.
Okay, all right.
Well, we're a little past the MTV generation. I'm talking about the MTV generation that,
that
produces
show kind of
The
like,
Hills and
yeah,
that kind
the
of
hills,
thing.
Yeah, The Hills, that kind of thing. Yeah, I know what you mean. I know.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it'll be challenging enough so that the but not challenging enough so that the – I'm trying to think of that famous Pauline Kael line. So the pretty young girls won't look puffy around the eyes when they see it or something – Pauline Kael said something very sarcastic. I've been reading The State of the Art, which is her collection of criticism from that time period, 84, 85.
Right.
In reading a lot of the reviews that she wrote for some of the movies we'll be covering tonight. And she's pretty merciless with some of them. But
this is when I started reading her, I think. Yeah, she was,
She appreciated Buckaroo Banzai. She appreciated the lunacy of it and the commitment of all of those actors. And she loved Dreamscape. She enjoyed the vision of that film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, she even gave a favorable review to Sheena.
Really? Sheena? Wow. That was supposed to make Tanya Roberts a big star. I'll never forget that, yeah.
Yes, and she was fairly positive about Purple Rain. I mean, she definitely liked Prince. I think she really dug the Prince's vibe, and thought that Morris Day was a heck of a great comedian.
Yeah, no, I mean, that movie, remember that movie was enormous for my freshman year of high school, that's all anyone talked about was Purple Rain.
Yeah.
That was just enormous at the time.
Yeah, and me as the world's biggest Prince fan. but oddly enough, I didn't become a Prince fan upon Purple Rain.
Okay.
It was years later. And it wasn't any of the movies, obviously.
It's amazing after that, the films that came after that never caught on. That was
Let me tell you. I found Graffiti Bridge at the video store, the movie store, on DVD for $1.97.
Wow.
And this is the movie. So I picked it up. As a movie, it's a great soundtrack. But I mean, oh. And I remember an interview with Prince years after it came out, and they mentioned how much it bombed. I think Prince's quote was, well, The Wizard of Oz wasn't appreciated upon its release either.
That's a classic Prince line.
Which I thought that The Wizard of Oz was thought upon favorably when it came out. But
well, it's amazing when your back is to the wall what you'll say.
Yeah, yeah. But obviously Prince, an enormous talent, and what a phenomenon Purple Rain became.
Yeah, and he, like Madonna, always reinvented himself musically, so he just always, you know, every couple of years he comes back, and it's, you know, he's amazing how fresh that he has been able
yeah.
to keep his music all these decades.
Oh, I'm going to go on about Prince in a little bit, because I'm crazy about him. But our next guest is on the line. And we love him. He's a big favorite of ours. We have him on as often as we can. Keith Ulick, one of our favorite critics, a great guy. He writes for Time Out New York. He's the contributing editor for The House Next Door. And talk about, we discussed this a little earlier, Jerry, in the show. Great material on the summer of '84. Great retrospectives on some of these seminal films. And a great moving remembrance of The Karate Kid that appeared on the site today.
Right.
The House Next Door Online.com is where you can find all of this great material. And we are thrilled to bring Keith Ulick back to the show. Keith?
Hello, hello.
Hey
buddy.
Back.
Hi, how am I sounding this time out? Because I know we had phone trouble last time.
You're sounding great. Loud and clear.
That's awesome.
Okay.
No problem so far.
And it's
great,
a good
great.
Thing that you are sounding loud and clear, because before we get into the summer of '84 stuff, and my apologies. My apologies to people that are listening to this on the archive in late July. It might be a little dated, but you just got out from a screening of Public Enemies,
yes,
and I want to know the scoop.
Yeah, we want to know the scoop.
where would you like me to start, Jamie and Jerry?
I don't know if I like the sound of that, but just start.
Well, first of all, you're actually a fan of Michael Mann, correct?
Oh yes, quite. I am, yes.
Okay, so where does this fall in his canon, in your opinion?
For me personally, it's not on the stratospheric level that Miami Vice Theatrical Cut Only is, which is one of my favorite movies of the decade, I'd say, and also I think like his ultimate masterpiece, personally.
That's a bold statement. That's what I love about you, Keith. You make the boldest statements. I love that. And I don't mean that in a condescending way at all, because I like Miami Vice, too.
Well, like bold statements that Miami Vice is like the best thing he's ever done? Or
yeah, because a lot of people, I mean, I like it, too. I always got frowns when I say I like that movie, so.
Yeah. Well, I think it's absolutely magnificent. But like I say, theatrical cut only, not the DVD director's cut.
Okay, fair enough.
Which I think is pretty much shits all over, you know, what the movie achieved in its theatrical version, but that's another story. As far as Public Enemies, I am really in love with it, though.
Cool.
I have to tell you. Yeah, so breathe a sigh of relief. Yeah, you know, if that helps. But it's, you know, it continues his really interesting use of video, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, Matt Seitz once said about Zodiac that he'd never seen night that way captured in movies before. You know, that the video used in Zodiac kind of showed him how night really was. And
yeah.
Okay.
And what Mann does with day in this film, especially in the wide shots of like blue sky and everything, is just absolutely incredible. More so, though, I'd say the film is definitely about getting intimate. With his video work, he always tends to get in really close on people. This is a film that's, I think, really shot, you know, mostly in close-up. It has more of a feel of there being a script, where I think Miami Vice just felt, you know, organic and to life, I'd say. It just felt like, you know, you were living it moment to moment. And I think there's an inevitability to Public Enemies that just comes from knowing, of course, how Dillinger ultimately meets his fate and
yeah.
such. And that's sort of there from like the beginning. But, you know, what nonetheless, it's still done in that present tense idiom, I'd say, that that Miami Vice had. And so, I mean, he talked about approaching a period piece in the press notes that I read. He talked about approaching it, you know, as if it was happening in the now, you know, that people were experiencing it now. He wasn't calling attention to the fact, per se, that it was the 30s or not, even though, you know, he pretty much recreates the 30s quite vividly. And such, or the pre-prohibition times, or you know, whatever it is. I think I'm forgetting exactly which years it actually does cover. Although I think what it says in the press notes is like the last 13 months of Dillinger's life, essentially. I mean, you know, it's kind of like he takes everyone from like Depp and Bale to, you know, the bit players like Channing Tatum and John Ortiz and everyone, and they all just like contribute to this, you know, this beautiful poem in motion, I'd say, about this particular period. And I mean, you know, I just recently seen Fassbender's film Effie Briest, which is a period piece done in a very unique way as well, and very different, of course, in terms of style and stuff. But it just you know, these both have got me thinking kind of about how one best approaches like a period piece, and you know, how you can make it a bit more, you know, how it does not feel just staid or like, you know, you're just focusing on the costumes or something. You know, the movie really feels lived in, and I'd say especially with the use of video, and especially in those wide shots, and also in the intimate like real close-up shots, it invites you to come towards it. I was talking about. Yeah, I was saying that it was kind of like a pointillist painting where if you wanted to see the points, you'd have to go to, like, the subatomic level. That's kind of, you know, the clarity of the image that he brings in this film.
Well, I feel that way about Michael Mann. I mean, his films are so immersive for me. It almost feels like you're existing in them.
Right. Yeah, and so I guess I'd say, you know, this doesn't trump Miami Vice for me, but it does seem like it's a development. It's sort of like story-wise, I think he's doing things that he's done many times before. I think, you know, maybe a lot of people will call it perhaps dismissively Heat with Tommy Guns, but, you know, but I think that, you know, you have to, you know, one of the, it basically is a movie that insists that you look at it. And deal with it sort of as a tactile experience, you know.
Yes,
and,
right.
And you just that you feel your way through it, and that really, I think, story for Mann and for a lot of American filmmakers of recent, you know, I think like Jonathan Demme and other people, you know, have been moving away from narrative as like the crutch on which they hang things. It's more the skeleton around which they build the kind of the meat of things. You know, and it's very, and it can be very thin sometimes, story and whatever, but that doesn't matter, you know. And here, you know, it's like, I think you probably sense the script a little bit more, and you might consider that a flaw, but frankly, I mean, I just was luxuriating in this thing the entire time, and I felt it. It's visceral. It's, you know, it's something that I'm kind of in awe of, if not like immediately emotionally moved by, you know, like I was with Vice like really got to me emotionally, but you know, to be in awe of it is just like, you know, it has its own incredible pleasures. So
okay,
yeah.
I have officially soiled myself. I am very excited.
Hold on, I need to go to the washing machine now.
Yeah.
You have wetter appetite. So
yeah, really.
Yeah. Well, come to New York next Thursday. We'll go to the press screening.
Okay, I'll
be
there.
I'm there. Okay.
We were talking about, before he got on the line, we were talking about Purple Rain, which was absolutely one of the major stories from the summer of '84 at the movies.
Yeah.
First of all, I think you're a little younger than I am.
I was 7 in '84.
Okay, so your consciousness of films at that time hadn't developed fully, or were you aware of these films upon their release?
I'm the closest R for the three of us.
You what did you say, Jerry? Sorry.
I'm the closest to ARP of the three of us. I'm the only one here.
Yeah.
Oh God.
No, that's okay. That's okay. You know, I mean, I was thinking though about, like, you know, what movies in the summer of '84, you know, had I seen in the theater and stuff. And, you know, as I was thinking about it, I was like, wow, I don't think I saw any of these things except for on videotape. You know, like,
right.
The big thing, I'd say the big year for me was 89. You know, 88 and 89, 88 is like Roger Rabbit, and that's
right.
Like the first one thing that I see in the theater that like really makes some kind of deep impression.
Mm-hmm.
Then 89, I've got like Batman and Indiana Jones and the
right.
Last Crusade, and I actually had this experience the other day. I went to a midnight showing of Last Crusade at Landmark Sunshine here in Manhattan, and and it was the first movie that I had seen in its original release that I had a really cognizant memory of seeing in its original release that I'm now seeing in rep. And you want to talk about, you know, thinking, sort of facing your own mortality in a way. it's kind of like I'd always wondered. One of the things I've always wondered is like, what happens when I start to see these things, you know, that I saw in first run, like in rep, many years later. And you know, it's now 20 years since Last Crusade came out in '89, and
yeah.
it was incredible because it looked like an old film. But I don't mean that like in a negative way, you know.
No.
Well,
you know,
no, but this is interesting because we've discussed this ourselves. When we go back to these movies and we, you know, earlier on the show we were talking to people from The Last Starfighter and Buckaroo Banzai. When you revisit these movies, it does. Did you feel that it kind of took you back to that time and like a feeling of innocence almost cloaks over you when you watch some of these?
Yeah. You know, I guess for me personally, I always try to stay in the moment that I'm in. And I can tell you that all the times I've watched, say, and I know we're in 89 here, but, you know, we're just
That's
talking
okay.
about it, I guess, thematically. But, you know, I mean, every time I've watched Last Crusade since its first run, it's always been great to me.
Mm-hmm.
And this just solidified that. You know, it solidified everything I feel about it. It solidified my love for it. It solidified how great, you know, Spielberg on the big screen often is,
mm-hmm.
But you know, it was like when I read my colleague Godfrey Cheshire on Crystal Skull, you know, he talked about going to see Raiders in its original run, and he was born in '51, and he like really hated Raiders at the time that it came out, but in seeing Crystal Skull, what he sort of saw was that what looked really fast and kind of abrasive in that moment in like '81. Suddenly had a classical feel to
yeah.
it, you know,
yeah.
that was sort of comparable. And he was saying to John Ford, you know, which I've always harped on something of the John Ford to a lot of the film brats comparisons, because God knows they reference The Searchers, like, you know.
Oh, everyone references The Searchers.
You know, especially the last shot of Wayne, you know, walking away from the door
yeah.
and the door closing
mm-hmm.
and stuff, you know. And, but I mean, just comparing in the sense of like, you know, Spielberg getting, you know, you start to see how his style has a full life to it now. It's no longer a work in progress. It's really starting to
mm-hmm.
culminate into something. And so that, you know, it just in watching Last Crusade again, I mean, you know, it was kind of like, wow, I can really see this film now in context in a way,
mm-hmm.
you know,
it,
and, you know, I guess it brings back certain memories, but I still feel like I'm experiencing it now because I try to look at movies sort of very much from a present tense perspective, always with an eye towards, you know, reevaluation and just accumulation of experience with them, you know, and I'm so familiar with Last Crusade now, but it never ceases to, you know, make me love it or just move me.
Well, something like A Purple Rain, though, that is
yeah.
so much of its time.
Yeah.
We've used that word a lot tonight, zeitgeist. I mean, it hit it. When you look back on it 25 years later,
right?
What pleasures does it maintain, do you think?
Well, yeah, and I guess I should say what's interesting about 84 is that I think a lot of those things are very much, you know, video revolution for me. So I caught up with them after the fact. So
right.
in that sense, it's like I'm not really remembering 84 in the moment per se. I don't really remember like the PG-13 rating and that whole brouhaha. You know, I'm sort of innocent to that. But, you know, in like visiting some of these things later, like I only saw Purple Rain for the first time, I'd say about 2 years ago. Still, I think that can gain some perspective because I was alive in 84 and I do have some memory of things like that. But, you know, what pleasures does it offer? Well, first of all, as my boyfriend says, he says derisively, but I say quite endearingly that Prince looks like a dancing, singing poodle. that alone is pleasure. You know, when he starts shaking his bum around in your face and stuff, it's kind of like, okay, this is, you know, I feel like the 80s, if they were a bad time for American movies, as a lot of people say, they really had some like incredible music. I think if we were to do like a retro of music in the 80s, you know, especially in the mainstream sector, I think you'd find a lot of really interesting stuff, you know, and just like, I don't know, just like, I love the whole, the really insane balladeering and bald-faced emotion that's like, that comes out in the 80s, and, you know, as opposed to like the introspective navel-gazing of the 90s, which I guess is like the you know, if you were to reduce it to like, you know, some
kind
of...
Well, there's a lot of truth in that description, so...
Yeah, you know, broad context or whatever, but, yeah, I mean, looking back at Purple Rain, you know, of course, you get things like Clarence Williams III, and you know, and Prince coming and looking for him and being like, "Where are you, motherfucker?" You know? I mean, he said, you know, what's great about it is that, yeah, it's kind of like, I guess there's a Cirque subversion in some of these things, and that Prince seems so just so fucking gay. I guess I can say that, and yet he's like macho at the same time. It's kind of like, again, I go back to what my boyfriend said. It's like only Gene Kelly could wear a pink shirt and be the epitome of masculinity.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's like there's something similar to Prince here in that, you know, I think a lot of, I don't think that was just like, from what I gather, I don't think it's just like a gay man's movie. It seems like a lot of straight guys love Purple Rain.
I adore Prince. I think he's one of the great musical geniuses. I never particularly cared for the film Purple Rain, but it was very valuable in obviously introducing the world to Prince. And whenever I see Prince, I've always seen a kind of amalgam of three influences. I see kind of the guitar god of Jimi Hendrix and the soul of a James Brown and the kind of prissy showmanship of a Little Richard.
I
think that's Prince.
That's very good. Yeah, I mean, that's a very
good
description.
Thank you.
I mean,
you can quote me on that.
But it's like, you know, he takes all these influences and he makes something really special out of it, you know.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, and Purple Rain is just such an absolutely incredible album anyway. You know, all the songs on it are just amazing, I think, and and very memorable. And you go back to the movie and I guess, you know, it's like there's something really powerful about it. And one of my best friends, Jeremiah Kipp, just, you know, swears by Purple Rain. He thinks it's a great story of like fathers and sons and disappointing your father and then trying to, you know, reconcile yourself over that. So, I mean, you know, there's, I mean, funny enough, on Dave Kerr's blog, there's been a whole argument recently about, from a lot of the American critics are saying how bad the 80s were, and then you've got people like Adrian Martin from Australia saying, like, wow, I was outside the 80s in America, and I just love everything, like Purple Rain, and Purple Rain was like a buzzword that they kept harping on, like he was going Purple Rain, and all the American guys like Blake Lucas and Mike Gross and others, you know, they just were like, great, what, Purple Rain? What? You know, it's like,
yeah,
what they didn't get it. And so, you know, I mean, I guess we have something to learn in that we often, you know, if we're in the midst of a specific time and a specific country's artistic output, I think we might tend to look down or away from certain things that maybe with time will really come to seem beautiful and mm-hmm. and definitive of things. It's very easy to miss things, and you know,
that's a good point.
I include myself in this. God knows what I'm missing too, but you know, I always try to, I do my best to keep an eye out for these things. You know, in all kinds of genres and all kinds of
mm-hmm.
doesn't matter where it comes from. I just think you got to look and find it. You know?
Yeah, yeah, and I'm hoping that you find Benjamin Button soon.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it yet.
Bring up a great point.
But I love your Kate Blanchett impression.
Well, I haven't heard that yet.
Oh, the Benjamin Button. And then the hurricane came, and my love for you was destroyed in Katrina. Oh, oh, Julia Ormond. I'm sorry. Anyway, I'll stop now.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I've only seen Cate Blanchett in like old age makeup, and Dan has forever done her like dance when she's like saying, "And there are lesbians in the company, Benjamin, and they're all in love with me." And it's like, okay, well, yeah. But then again, I'm a big fan of Blanchard is Irina Spalko, so who am I to talk? So, yeah.
All right, anyway. Go ahead, Jerry. You had something you want to add?
Yeah.
No, he brings up a good point. You know, it wasn't until this, you know, as I got older that I really went back and looked at a lot of the films of the 80s, and the ones that I dismissed at the time, you know, you go back and watch them, and, you know, you find merit in them. I think Keith brings up a very good point about that.
Here's a clip from another kind of seminal, I'm using that word again.
You said a lot tonight.
I know, I really have.
I'll stay away from that one.
Okay, from a very influential 80s movie, and I know this is very dear to all of our hearts.
Ogre!
Well, anyway, college is a whole new ballgame.
Ogre!
People judge you differently than they did in high school.
Ogre!
Where are they? I think they're talking about us. No way.
Ogre!
Come on, Lewis, let's go.
The story of our lives, otherwise known as Revenge of the Nerds.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Jerry, do you have any special recollections about this film?
I enjoyed it. I haven't seen it in a long time, to be honest with you, but I remember this was like one of those films we saw during that summer, and then, you know, that we rented a lot on VHS when it came out. Very funny. I wasn't crazy about the sequel, but aren't they remaking this too?
They might be, yeah, I think so.
I mean, aren't they, everything we're talking about tonight, isn't it being remade?
So far, except for Purple Rain 2, but a couple of the movies that we've already mentioned are being remade.
Yeah.
Nerds, I remember being very fond of that movie growing up.
I think we all were at some point.
Yeah, I identified very strongly with that film.
Yeah.
But these the teen genre, actually, and you know, one of the major directors that came about in the 80s, obviously, was John Hughes, and such a strong voice in that world. Tell me your impressions of that genre of film, especially looking back on it now as an adult. What value it holds for you now?
Jerry, do you want to go first?
No, you're the guest of honor here. I'd like you to go first, actually.
Okay. Looking back on the teen genre, again, it's a strange thing. You know, I think when I was young, I wanted to grow up really fast, and
mm-hmm.
so I kind of went through my snobby phase in, I think, when I was, like, you know, in like, middle school or whatever, and I kind of sort of turned my nose down at some of these at some of the films that we're talking about and kind of appreciating tonight, and only came back around to them a little later, strangely enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it was always a process, and there, of course, were certain things that I really loved. I mean, you know, it's kind of like, I'd say, I don't know if the teen genre ever really held much interest for me. You know, if we're talking like lowbrow comedy, I was thinking, you know, I was more a Police Academy serious guy for some bizarre reason. You know, so it's not like I was turning, it's not like I was like just trying to pursue the intellectual high life all the time, you know, I mean, but there was always kind of a desire in me, I think, as I'm recalling it, to, you know, try to be better than some of these things, until ultimately I realized, you know, you can find beauty in a lot of different places, and you should always try to look for it there. And I mean, you know, in going back, of course, you know, I from the John Hughes stable, I mean, I certainly see the beauty in something like Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Or was there an 84 movie that he made? Because Breakfast Club was 85, right?
But the 16 Candles in 84.
Yeah, and you see, here's a blind spot. I've never seen 16 Candles, nor have I seen Pretty in Pink. So,
oh, wow.
You know, yeah. So it's kind of like I do come into the John Hughes thing kind of late, you know, and have kind of left it unexplored to some degree.
Well, yeah, and 16 Candles is May, in that summer, May 4th, I believe.
Yeah,
and
we can't talk about that, can we?
Sure.
No,
there's no embargo. But,
oh, okay. Cool.
A lot of great influential movies came out in that first half of the summer, and Aaron, our good friend Aaron at Back by Midnight, he's covering a lot of these films on his show with a lot of these filmmakers.
Right.
And Aaron, I know your call is on the line, and I'll get to you in just 1 second. But stuff like Ghostbusters,
yeah.
Gremlins,
yeah.
And for me, probably the most important film for me that summer, Temple of Doom, was important to me.
And you know what? In your saying that, I'm realizing what this is. I think teen movies reminded me too much of real life.
Yeah.
And what I think I was looking for when I was at that age, because I was, I had the fair share of bullies and kind of ostracizing and stuff, was something a bit more fanciful. And I think that's probably why I gravitated more towards like fantasy and science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I seem to recall seeing Explorers, which as I recall is 85.
Yeah, that's 85, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be like something that really sticks out to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish I could pinpoint 84 a bit more, but it's kind of a lost years in some ways.
Actually, what you're talking about fits in with Revenge of the Nerds, because I felt much the same way as a kid, and I think deep down a lot of us feel that way. But I was very bullied and picked upon, and I was kind of a weak kid, and, you know, I sang Barry Manilow and did plays and things. I mean, I wasn't very popular. But movies like Revenge of the Nerds or, you know, most of all, something like Karate Kid that came out that summer, that really played on that, and I think that was the appeal, especially of that film, for me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
No, yeah, I mean, there's certainly that, and, you know, in a sense, it was kind of like some of these movies at their best were all about the an individual triumphing over, you know, these excessive forces and stuff, which just like so perfectly 80s in a lot of ways, and of course the paradox being that a lot of these individualist parables were coming from, you know, a corporate mentality. So there's interesting paradoxes in how these all come through, and yet like Miyagi and Daniel LaRusso are so vivid nonetheless as characters. And I think Craig Simpson, who wrote the Appreciation on the House, really delved into what he felt personally. I mean, I mean, it kind of just proves to me, again, that even something that's primarily a corporatized piece of art can carry something in it that's so indescribably human and touching, and you just have to look for it. It's not like it's all bad just because of where it comes from, you know, necessarily or whatever. You know, it's like, you know, it's just a confluence of things, and sometimes it just works so beautifully, and you have to account for the fact that for different people it's going to mean different things, and you know, it's like I guess the fantasy kind of angle that I always tried to go for, you know, just helped me I don't know if escape is the right word, but it certainly helped me to deal with who I was and where I was.
No, escape is the right word. That's
there are movies like that. There, like from that summer, like The Last Starfighter, and like The Neverending Story, or Cloak and Dagger, where someone of that age,
I remember loving
Cloak and Dagger.
Cloak and Dagger in the theater, and the kid in front of us kept yelling, like telling Henry Thomas what to do. You want to do this? No, you want to do that.
But actually, it's the kid that goes on his own adventure and escapes, like you're talking about.
Yeah. And he has an imaginary friend, Dabney Coleman, and basically I remember that movie. I remember the ending, especially with like the rusted digging machine or whatever that sort of mimics like a monster in some ways. There are things that really scarred me in a lot of ways, or were like really big representations of like fears I had or whatever. So many people I think kind of look back at their childhood and kind of poo-poo it and say, oh, I grew up or something like that. But it's not that we should revert to childhood, but I think, respect who you were.
Yeah.
And take it with you to where you are. Remember it. Your opinions might have changed, but, you're still that person to some degree because you went through that experience. And it's like, you don't need to say, oh, I grew away from that, therefore I'm better. I don't think that's the case.
Sometimes the opposite is true. Touch on something, Keith, that you brought up earlier. You said when you were at that age about the teen comedies or whatever, the teen genre, you wanted to grow up. You wanted to grow up at that point. I remember in junior high, now this is especially the eighth grade, which would be the summer of 84. I remember on weekends I would sit in my room, I was just like, I just would like to get to my life already.
Yeah,
I would like to already grow up. And then when you get to that stage, you're like, no, I want to go back to that. and it's a theme. And that's why I think the teen genre, while I like some of the films that we've talked about, a lot of them really hit more closer to home, like in my late 20s and especially my 30s. I really sort of gravitated towards them more.
For me, I think, I don't know, it's something that I kind of look at more with an intellectual distance than really have any much emotional investment in, as far as the teen genre is concerned. And I think maybe part of it is that I always did kind of want to get to where I feel like I am now in my 30s and feeling a bit more settled, hormones settled a bit more, career settled a bit more, bit more comfortable and stuff. Not that I want to get too comfortable necessarily to the point that I'm not prepared for the many challenges that I've still yet to face, which I'm sure are coming. But, being a teenager, I think I knew intuitively when I was young that it was something that I wasn't really going to enjoy. And then when I did go through it, it's not living under an evil Shah or something like that, or a dictator, but and with a constant fear of death. But you feel sometimes like just horrible and I really hated those years deeply. And so I think I kind of rebelled against the teen genre because it just reminded me too much of my own, of what I was going through, and why would I want to see that in a movie?
Speaking of a movie that made a lot of people feel horrible that summer, and it brings upon a confession that I must make to you both.
Oh my God.
Okay.
About 6 months ago, I rewatched this movie, and I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Okay.
I laughed my ass off. It was very entertaining to me.
And that film was Showa.
It wasn't Showa. It was you won't believe this. It was Rhinestone.
Rhinestone.
Wow, okay. Wow, there's a name from the past. Wow.
Yes.
Sylvester Stallone,
Dolly
Parton.
Yeah.
Right.
Singing.
So
in rhinestones, yes. I'm sorry, yeah.
Greatest, this one may be the greatest plug this movie's ever gotten.
25 years too late.
Yeah.
Confess, Jamie, confess.
Go on.
Well, I just thought, you know, I just thought it worked. When I watched it about 6 months ago, and I even feel myself that I must be on drugs feeling this way, but I could not believe it. I was laughing. I was enjoying it. You know, the typical fish out of water story. Mm-hmm. Stallone doesn't have great instincts when it comes to picking comedic roles, I guess. But I thought that he was the high point of Rhinestone. I can't believe I'm admitting this, but
I
did feel that way.
This makes sense because we're getting the Rhinestone Cobra double feature tribute show. I know that's what we're getting.
Now, Cobra is a classic.
I'll take that to the grave.
Well, and you know, if I might interject, I have to say I do think Stallone, whether intentional or not, is very good at comedy. Frankly,
yes.
I'm gonna put that out there. I think he has a comic sensibility and sometimes a tongue in cheek. And
right.
You know, I mean, and yeah, thinking of like Oscar, I think from 1991,
mm-hmm.
Some of the scenes in Demolition Man that he does.
Yeah,
you know.
Or Tango and Cash.
Yeah, Tango and Cash, and then you know, I even think like Rambo to some degree, you know,
mm-hmm.
or Rocky, you know. I mean, they're so exaggerated at a certain
yeah.
point, you know, to the point that I mean, and you know, I'm like a huge fan of the latest Rambo. Film like
me too,
are.
Me
I think
too.
Like, all are. Yeah.
Like insane. Like that movie, and it's amazing that of course I'm in love with a movie that has as its lead villain a homosexual pedophile. But you know, but for some reason that film is just like so keyed into his psyche or something, and it's such
yeah.
it is such a brute place to be. But out of that, you know. You know, it's like one of the first lines he has in the movie. It's like feeding the snakes. He's like, "Boom, it's a war zone."
Man, like, you do Stallone, you do Kate Blanchett. What,
yeah,
what
I mean,
can't
what
you
do?
There's plenty I can't do, believe me. But yeah, but I mean, you know, it's just like there's something really funny about that too. And I mean, that Rambo is just like so exaggerated in some way that, and yet it's such a potent. Vision of, I guess, what I would say is mainly a right-wing interventionist policy
right,
kind of
right.
film, but you know, damn, I mean,
oh, it is so amped up to 11.
Yeah,
I'm so thankful he didn't sanitize that
no,
movie.
No, I mean that thing is fucking insane, and
mm-hmm.
and but it's all fully to express his point of view, and you know what. Whatever one's perspective, I do respect the person who really has the strength of their convictions. You know,
yeah.
I don't. You know, it's not like a Bill O'Reilly thing because I don't think Bill O'Reilly has the strength of his convictions. You know, I think he's just like you know a firemonger. He just shouts.
Oh, he's like
Stallone,
Andy Griffith in the face
yeah.
of the crowd. That's what all those guys are like.
I think Stallone absolutely believes. In what he says, even when the things he says are just so utterly ridiculous, and maybe this feeds back into Rhinestone, you know, I think probably the reason you enjoy it is because he believes in it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
and that
yeah.
and that comes across, and that comes across in some way, shape, or form. And you know, you can argue about the quality of the movie or performances, et cetera, and all the different elements. But he, at his best, he's one of those guys. I think probably Schwarzenegger and you know, Willis, too. They all are like action heroes who have, you know, a comic sensibility to it that I wouldn't even really claim as ironic. They have an ease, you know, and an enjoyment with things. And I don't,
you know,
and I, you go ahead, yeah.
You know, it's something that a lot of people call a guilty pleasure, but I don't,
yeah.
It's not that I think Rhinestone is a particularly good movie. But
right.
perhaps it is because I watched it and I enjoyed it. And that is my recommendation for the week. Rewatch Rhinestone.
Okay.
People will laugh at you when you pick up, I don't even think it's on DVD, but when you pick up the old VHS somewhere at a garage sale, people will laugh at you, but be brave.
Okay.
But remember, Keith of all people said last summer, there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure.
I know, right. I know. There's thought that, you know, there is no such thing. I know yourself and Armand also says the same thing.
Yeah.
Here goes us mentioning Armand again. I want to talk about one more movie real quick before I take Aaron's call and get some closing thoughts, and that is Red Dawn. We mentioned it briefly a little earlier.
What are
your thoughts on that one, Keith?
Well, now, Milius is an interesting case because there's a guy who, like Stallone with the new Rambo, is so right-wing, but so has the strength of his convictions also. You know, and if you see a lot of Milius's work, I'd say from Dillinger, funny enough, his Dillinger movie is really excellent.
And The Wind of the Lion.
The Wind of the Lion is incredible.
Yeah.
Big Wednesday, his surfing movie, unbelievable.
Yes,
Conan the Barbarian, terrific.
Yeah.
Red Dawn is perhaps one of the stupidest, most idiotic movies ever made.
Well, wait a second. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Do you think, were you too unconvinced that the Nicaraguans and the Cubans could pull that off?
Well, wait, it's the Cubans and the Russians, right? Or
and the
Nicaraguans,
too. The Nicaraguans are in it, too, I believe.
See, okay, so it's basically like every American whipping boy of the 80s is villain in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my friends Jeremiah and I, we just do the scene, like, where they're parachuting down into the schoolyard, and, like, the black teacher comes out, and he's like, oh, hi, can I help you guys? he gets shot down, it's like, I mean, and then, of course, you know, you go around shouting, Wolverines everywhere, and, I mean, you know, that's one that I caught up with, like, way after the fact, but I was actually talking about it with some people today, just because, you know, and it's like, they remembered, like Matt Seitz remembered, like seeing it in the movie theater. And,
yeah, I remember that in the theater too.
And seeing the scene where Harry Dean Stanton is behind the fence and he's like, "Avenge me, boy!" And basically he was saying, you know, he said, "I knew my critical faculties were developing at that time, so I knew that this was the stupidest thing ever. But I was crying like a baby." Because he said it got to him on a father-son level,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, I mean, you know, Milius, and I haven't seen anything past Red Dawn, I don't think.
Oh,
I haven't
you've
seen
never
Flight
seen
of the Intruder or...
Farewell of the King or Flight of the Intruder, that's it.
No, I think that is it. And then he did a magnificent script for Geronimo, which Walter Hill directed. So,
I have a confession about John Milius to make, but...
Yeah.
I know, I actually kind of, a friend of mine worked with him trying to get something off the ground. It never took off for TV in the middle of the decade. It was about the Coast Guard.
Yeah.
And it was a TV series about the Coast Guard, and it just never took off. But that was the last I ever heard of anything that he was working on, and that was 2003.
Well, he was involved in Rome, which was on HBO,
true.
and I actually wish that Rome had been a bit more Milius-y, you know, I mean, he's just, I mean, you know, you see him in interviews, and he's like this big bearded guy with a gun in one hand and, like, you know, a cigar in the other, and it's just like, okay, you know, you're working this, I get it, and, you know, he
killed my brother.
Yeah, and I mean, he has written one of my favorite lines ever, which is Sean Connery and The Wind and the Lion, when he's like, "Let there be jihad. Let the swords run with the blood of the infidels. We will all eat lamb in paradise."
Yeah.
It's genius.
At UNC, and my brother is like screenwriting class when he was in film school, and he said, "I have like 150 guns. If you come to my property, I'll kill you."
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
like, wow, okay.
Yeah, but Red Dawn, you know, it's, it really struck a nerve with a lot of teens, from what I'm to understand. You know, like my friend Jeremiah. You know, he's older than me, and he was like a teenager at that time. And you know, he said he would go to school, and he hated Red Dawn. He still does hate it. You know, but he would go to school, and like all these people would be like, "Hey, you know, what if the Russians came down and attacked us? Do you think we could survive in the woods and stuff?" You know, they were like really like role playing. It gave them it was like a real power fantasy in a lot of ways. And, you know, I mean, but, yeah, you know, it's like I can really get behind, like, every Milius movie before then, you know, even with the political content.
Yeah.
That's one that, you know, Red Dawn is just so profoundly stupid in everything it's trying to say, even though it's done with a certain degree of, you know, I guess maybe I'd probably call it camp value right now.
Yeah,
it's, just,
it's
yeah.
a militia
so,
film from what I understand.
It's just so ridiculous. I mean,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it just doesn't. It seems to be just like. It seems to be a joke, right? Where I would not say that about Milius's other movies, you know, before
Wind
that.
Wind and the Lion.
Yeah, you know, Wind and the Lion is, yeah, I mean, the you know, the vividness of Connery is like the Moor and I think it's, is it Keith, David Keith? Or, no, who plays, not David Keith, wait.
No, it's Brian Keith. Is he
Brian
quintessential,
Keith,
quintessential TR.
Right. Brian Keith is Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, you know, I mean, it's just like incredible, and the fact that they never meet, but they have this kind of communication anyway. You know,
yeah.
I mean, that and just like the wartime, the Vietnam wartime romance of like the Big Wednesday and stuff, and
mm-hmm.
just how epic that is. I mean, I say to people that Big Wednesday is it's as if Leni Riefenstahl directed a surfing movie. Yeah.
That's classic. No, but Wind and a Lion is one of my favorite. I would say that's my favorite Sean Connery performance.
All right, let me get to Aaron's call. We have 15 minutes left. Get
right,
some
right.
of his insights into some of these movies, and then I want to mention just real quickly some of the other releases from that summer.
And then you want to talk about Public Enemies again.
<Don't
we> Oh, by the way, this Sunday on the big show we have Bill Pullman and Keith's favorite actress, Julia Armand, on Geeks United. It's going to be a good one.
The best performance she ever gave was in Inland Empire, but yeah.
Wow. Well, we'll talk about
Aaron.
That later.
Okay.
Aaron, hey, buddy.
How you doing? Hey, Keith, how you doing?
Aaron.
Hey, what's up, Aaron?
What's up, guys? I just want to know, maybe Keith can have some insight. How can a movie called Rhinestone not be a icon in the gay community?
That's a very good question, I suppose. Maybe it's because both of the stars at its center are just so over-exaggerated that even us queers are saying, no, we ain't having that. Yeah. I mean, you put Sly next to Dolly. You know, you put Sly in his, like, Bird with a War Zone next to Dolly and her tits, and it's just like, you know, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to make sure, because I hadn't thought about it. I hadn't thought about Rhinestone until Jamie brought it up, and so then my mind started wandering.
I do nothing but think about it, Aaron.
I know you do. God love the late, great Bob Clark.
That's a classic.
It is a classic.
That and Loose Cannons. Great.
Oh, God. Loose Cannons.
Loose Cannons, which also should have starred Dolly Parton. Yeah.
I think that's her nickname now. It's Lou, they call her Loose Cannon.
Yes.
Oh. Snap. Anyway.
It's interesting. You brought up you played a clip of Revenge of the Nerds, and I find that film interesting now in context of to really give an idea of how the pendulum has swung in 25 years of summer. That now the frat boys have kind of taken over the Hollywood scene. I mean. With The Hangover, I mean, it's the total opposite. So I find that kind of interesting, that too, mirroring effect. But to go back, 25, I mean, that's what Revenge of the Nerds was kind of, you know, outcrying against. And now the frat boys, if you will, they're now the mainstream, and they're now the cute and cuddly. It's like almost now the frat boys are the outcasts and the misunderstood ones.
We've lost the macho-ness or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
well, there's something to be said. I mean, you could almost take that as because, you know, fraternity things are such an associated with Republican values and that sort of thing, and that's out of, you know, that's on the decline. So there is something. You could make a big case about The Hangover and even Old School for that matter.
Yeah.
The success of The Hangover is something I've been analyzing just for a couple of days now just because it is a diverting comedy, and it is funny, but I find its success disproportionate to the quality of the film, and I find it endlessly fascinating. But
sequel next summer.
Oh yeah.
That's true.
Wow, that's. Yeah.
So what other impressions do you have of some of these titles we've already mentioned for 84?
84. I mean, you know, I agree with you. Keith is only 1 year older than me, and so I don't. I was going to the movies at that time, so I remember seeing Temple of Doom, Gremlins, Ghostbusters in the theater, The Karate Kid in the theater. I remember seeing those. But I am probably, I do align myself with Keith in that while I did see them in a theater, it wasn't until, you know, a year or two later when they were on TV and on tape that they really become, you know, part of your consciousness, I think.
Yeah. I mean, if I remember 84 in any degree, it's really because I saw the films after the fact on tape and on TV. And maybe it pointed up to me what, you know, what the primacy of television in my life in some way. You know?
And what I find interesting about, you know, with these past two summer shows that we've done with 84 and 83 last year is that even though a whole generation, you know, the quote-unquote internet or critics, if you will, you know, they might not have seen these films in the theater once or maybe not, but, you know, we all saw them on TV and on tape. So it is these two summers in particular that provided the films that I think have cultivated, at least in our pre-pubescent adolescence, that a lot of these films are the ones that we, you know, liked or disliked was kind of, a side note. These are the ones that were constantly on the loop. I remember, you know, I don't know how many times I saw Ghostbusters on tape, you know, just watching it every day. And I don't even know if, you know, I haven't seen it in a while, so I don't even know if it still holds up, but it was one of those things that, you know, it was something different that just kind of, whatever you took from it, it helped cultivate your critical sensibilities at a later date.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Keith.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
I was going to go to another topic, but go ahead if you want to follow that.
No, I was just going to say, as far as the video thing, I'm remembering now that the tape that I played the most was actually Return of the Jedi from 83.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
And that was sort of like, that was the first tape I rented from a video store, and it was the first one that I taped off of television and played continuously.
Right.
Strangely enough, you know, and so it's kind of like my film going always had video in it in some way, shape, or form.
Right.
And or television. And I certainly loved the experience of the theater, but I think my mind was prepped from an early stage to really accept the fact that there were a lot of ways to experience a movie. You know, there are a lot of people who say that it's imperative that you see a movie only in the theater. And I think, you know, that argument is really moot right now, especially now when really the access to things or the way you access things has been so opened up, you know,
right.
Downloading to video still, but, you know, there's, to watching it on your iPod, you know, it's kind of like there's so many different ways to do it, and I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what are the kids who are growing up now, if they have a podcast 20 years down the line, if they talk about the movies of, like, 2004 or 2009.
Right. Right.
You know, what's that going to be like? Yeah,
let's go to our lightning round in our last 10 minutes here. I want quick kind of observations, the first thing that comes to your head about some of these titles.
Okay.
You each get a title each. We'll go around in a circle, pretend like we're sitting around in a circle.
Okay.
Starting with you, Keith, from the summer of 84, The Natural.
Wow, The Natural. You know, never seen it.
okay,
yeah.
Next, Aaron.
Oh, really? No, I mean, I did have something to say, though. I mean,
okay, go ahead.
Let the man speak. Let the man speak.
Yeah, it's, you know, Barry Levinson, who had Diner, it seems, and then slowly went down in a lot of people's estimations, probably deservedly so. There was another thread on Dave Kerr's blog where basically Levinson was getting bitch-slapped back and forth about being a hack and everything, and they were kind of using it to also bash, like, Redford and his kind of wishy-washy liberalism and stuff,
right.
You know, I think is perfectly fine. I remember, you know what, there's a subject, baseball movies. I avoided those like the plague, so there you have it.
Well, that one looked like a Wheaties commercial. Okay.
Okay.
Next movie, Aaron, Firestarter.
Firestarter. This is one of those weird films in that one of those HBO staples, and I watched many, many times. And as I've seen it recently, it's an odd film in that it owes more to Dead Zone than to Carrie. It's not as good as either one of those films, but it is kind of a cross between an apocalyptic fireball and a rather surprisingly moving father-daughter story. And it's a weird film. It's apocalyptic vision of a. Here, I'll get a little critical on you. It's an apocalyptic vision of a young female adolescent sexuality channeled into kinetic ability to start fires.
I think that's fair. Okay, Jerry?
Yeah.
Once Upon a Time in America.
Oh, you knew you had to ask me that one. I didn't see that one in the theater, but I've watched it countless times. I love it. I mean, it's just, you know, leave it to an Italian to make a movie about Jewish gangsters. and
perfect,
make it work.
Perfect.
And make it work.
I don't know whether or not to ask you about this, Keith.
Go ahead.
Cannonball Run 2.
Even if he hasn't seen it, he should have an opinion of it.
No, you know, it's reminding me actually of something Walter Shaw said about Sean Connery, which is that he's the Scottish Burt Reynolds, which is very cruel, but if you look at some of Connery's worst films, it kind of starts to make a weird kind of sense.
It does,
But, you know, Cannonball Run 2, Burt Reynolds and Sally Field and, you know, driving their cars and in Hal Needham style, and I also never saw it, so.
Well, good. We're batting 1,000, man.
Yeah.
Okay, Aaron, here's your next challenge, Electric Dreams.
Wow.
A underrated film, actually, with a terrific score by Giorgio Moroder. We're talking about great.
Yay.
Talking about music in the 80s.
You
know, gotta love Moroder.
Hell yeah.
And I do agree, 80s music is some of the best music, and I do think 80s movies, 80s as a movie decade is actually underrated, and I'm glad it's being reappraised. Electric Dream is a weird, one-of-a-kind kind of computer romance, and it should not work. It should not work. Somehow it does work if you get on its wavelength. It works quite charmingly, and it has a very lovely performance by Virginia Madsen. And Lenny Von Dolan in the lead, as the nerdy lead, has a surprisingly convincing amount of anger. It's kind of an angry David Byrne. It's David Byrne with emotion.
Wow.
Okay.
That's a good point.
Well, hey, you really came through on that one. Okay, Jerry, are you ready for your next challenge?
Oh, shit. Go for it.
The Woman in Red.
Oh, man, that's just, I don't know. No Mel Brooks, Gene Wilder. I'm sorry, I never got into it. I mean, yeah, I watched it, but
I'll tell you one thing about Woman in Red. It is the first time I saw a woman's genitalia on film, on the lower region.
Oh, yeah,
and
I mean, I'll give it points for that. I mean,
I must have played that thing. I wore that tape out, let me tell you. My mother caught me one time.
Oh.
But I do want to say something. I always felt it was a shame that Gilda Radner never got a movie that, like, really
was worthy of her talent.
Yeah, that's the thing that I find so sad about those films.
Yeah. Keith.
Yes, sir.
Dreamscape.
Dreamscape. You know, you're giving me all these titles that I haven't seen, and I don't.
Sheena.
Have
you seen Sheena?
I haven't seen Sheena. Do you have anything else for me?
Tightrope. Have you seen Tightrope?
I've seen Tightrope.
Okay,
I've seen Tightrope.
All right, give him Tightrope. Give him.
Can I have Tightrope?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
A Clint Eastwood movie that I recall, again, from a more future vantage point on that, because I was taking a Clint Eastwood course when I was just about to graduate high school. I was auditing it in the city. And,
oh, God.
And Tightrope was one of the things that came up. And we sort of got into the history of Tightrope and how, that's one of the rare kind of films that Eastwood didn't direct that he was sort of heavily involved in the production on. I think Mel Paso was pretty heavily involved in it. And yet, I think it was kind of like a Poltergeist situation in that he did sort of ghost direct it and or really sort of sped the production along because the director's name escapes me at this time.
Robert
Tuggle. Kind of,
Tuggle,
thank you,
yeah.
Tuggle, right, exactly. Just kind of was slow and Eastwood kind of like pushed him along. And I just remember it, you know, being really kind of nasty, and isn't Genevieve Bujold in it?
Yeah, yes. I think so. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember, I remember her being really, really terrific in it. And I remember that there's like a chase scene, I think, at the end where the killer ultimately gets run over by a train.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, it,
I haven't
just
seen this in a long time. Wow.
Yeah, it's a sort of underrated, I think, and as I remember it, and very kind of moody and quiet.
You know, and it is directed by Richard Tuggle, and ironically, Dick Tuggle is exactly what I was doing when I was watching The Woman in Red.
Oh.
Come on, you got to admire the mind.
And then Hurricane Katrina came, Benjamin.
Wow.
And we, Richard Tuggle, each other.
Aaron, I'll give you the last one. Chud.
Cannibalistic
so
Humanoid Underdweller.
You should have given this one to Keith. He is the New Yorker. Have you ever seen a Chud?
Yeah, you should have given me Chud 2, Bud the Chud, because one of our NYU professors directed it, and Bud the Chud is the incomparable and wonderful Garrett Graham, who plays Beef in, what's it called, The Phantom of the Paradise by De Palma, and also is the voice of Franklin Sherman, the father to Jay Sherman on The Critic. So,
okay,
you know, all props to Garrett Graham. He's an underrated genius.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's all the time we have. We have 6 seconds left. Keith, what do you want to plug?
Public Enemies, yay!
Okay, guys, thank you. Tune in to Aaron's show tomorrow night, the conclusion of our three-part series on the summer of 84. Keith, you're awesome. Jerry, you know you're awesome.
Thank
Aaron,
you.
Aaron, you
you're
too.
All awesome.
Good night, guys.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.